We're tackling the latest on the pandemic front with a top Wisconsin infectious disease physician who's helped us navigate the past 20 months, fielding your questions about COVID here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. First, let's get a read on our year-end membership drive that is officially underway. I'm with Susanna Michaels, and it is Giving Tuesday here on the Ideas Network. You count on WPR for in-depth discussions, and it's your support that keeps these conversations going strong. Your gift right now makes a big difference both this year and as we head into 2022 at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And Kate, we do have this really exciting opportunity today. When you donate, you can be one of 350 people to help secure an additional $15,000 for WPR programs. A group of generous members have created this Giving Tuesday challenge to inspire your support of the programs that you and your entire community rely on.
Oh, that is so great. And your participation is vital. You bring WPR one step closer to meeting this challenge. Give now. Any amount makes a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. That's WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
In the first part of this hour, we heard from the mayor of Washburn. I really appreciated that conversation. It's keeping me in touch with what life is like in the variety of settings we have in Wisconsin. I live in a city. I'm learning about the challenges and issues of a small town. And those are the kinds of conversations you can count on every day from The Morning Show.
And WPR is listener supported. That means that your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It makes the many cities and topics that you learn about and tune in for every day possible. Choose an amount that works for you, then make your gift.
And maybe that amount is a dollar a day for your Wisconsin public radio listening. When you think about it, a dollar a day is actually a really great value. It's far less than a cup of coffee or a soda or a day of cell phone service.
That's right. A dollar a day. It comes out to $30 a month. And you can set that up as a monthly transfer from your bank account or charge to your credit card. Make your gift now in the amount that's right for you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I'm Margo Potacek, and I'm from Madison, Wisconsin.
And I'm Betty Potacek from Madison. If we want to keep Wisconsin Public Radio, we have to support it.
There have been times when I haven't been able to give, even between the time I was a student and now. Even if you're able to give a little bit, I think that makes a big difference. And the sustaining membership, where automatically every month it comes out of your checking account, you don't notice it so much that way. And it's super easy, and I think it makes a difference.
Feel good and make a difference right now at WPR.org.
That's right. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Susanna Michaels. It's listener support that is the biggest source of funding for the WPR programs you rely on. And that's why your support during this year-end member drive is so important. Maybe your gift is $10 a month. Maybe you set it at $100 a month. Whatever amount you choose, that is the right amount.
And the day is young. You can make a difference right now before the sun has fully risen. Donate to Wisconsin Public Radio at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You will feel great all day, and you will know that you made an important impact right from the get-go.
And our Giving Tuesday challenge still in effect today when 350 people make a gift for WPR 350. That means $15,000 from generous members will be secured for the WPR programs you rely on.
And we do have, we haven't mentioned it yet, these thank you gifts this drive. They're food bank thank you gifts. So when you give $10 or $20 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Not only will you make a difference for WPR, you can also provide hunger relief to people in your community.
So now is a great time to become a sustaining member. Easy to set up, convenient, ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card. Get started now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you for your support. Now to the pandemic, where in Wisconsin, young people 19 and under account for about 1 in 5 confirmed COVID cases, according to the latest state health department data. But most hospitalizations are hitting the elderly the hardest. What questions are on your mind about COVID, about the Omicron variant? Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Health, Professor of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Omicron variant first. This variant has really put the world on high alert. How serious of a threat is this? What is your initial assessment?
Well, we know that it's transmissible pretty easily because it's popping up around the globe in very short order. So at least as contagious as Delta, potentially a little bit more. But beyond that, you know, it's a lot of speculation. You know, for instance, the concerns are, will the vaccines work as well against it? And I think the answer is we don't know at this point, but it would be very unusual for the vaccines to not work at all. You know, it's possible that there could be a little decline in effectiveness, but likely not a lot. But we don't really know the answer to that at this point.
The WHO, the World Health Organization, is really urging the world to work together to contain this variant that was detected by scientists in Africa. And if shutting down borders isn't likely to stop the spread, what will work to contain this highly mutated virus?
Well, I think the measures that work against COVID, you know, there's the non-vaccine related measures, which is masking and distancing and hand hygiene and all the other things that you do for respiratory viruses. And then there's the biggest thing, which is the vaccines. And of course, there's a lot of inequity in vaccine access and distribution in various parts of the world. And it just goes to show you, I mean, it's a global pandemic. So focusing on just one part of the world isn't going to contain the global aspect of it.
You mentioned masking, and last week we saw Dane County health officials extend the indoor mask mandate to January 3rd. The county health officials say almost 76% of residents are vaccinated, and Dane County was the only Wisconsin county to have an indoor mask mandate as of October. How much difference do masks make?
So masks are an adjunct to vaccine. You know, none of these measures are an either or. They're supposed to be used as a suite of solutions. So masking is most helpful when you're in closed, crowded situations where you don't know what the vaccine status of other people is like, or if your immune system is compromised such that you're concerned that perhaps the vaccine won't work as well as it would in people who are immunocompetent. So all of these are add-ons, and when things are not going in the right direction, such as, you know, with this emergence of this new mutant and potentially the fact that case counts are going up, then masking is a very useful adjunct.
We still should pay attention, I would imagine, to the kind of mask we're wearing and how we wear the mask.
Yeah, so the ideal mask is something that is comfortable, so you're not always touching it and trying to adjust it. It's snug fitting, but yet breathable, and it's multi-layered. If you're using a disposable mask, I think, you know, we've had such trauma from the lack of PPE in the earlier days of the pandemic that people are reusing these masks probably longer than they should. So if it's a disposable mask, then dispose of it. And if it's a reusable mask, then think of it like a handkerchief, which is that you'll want to wash it very frequently. And that's really what masking is. What we see is that people are sometimes wearing the mask, but it's slipping down because it's not snug enough. They're always having to tug it up, and touching your nose and mouth is not a good idea because it defeats the purpose. So a good mask works. A mask that isn't worn right probably is counterproductive.
We've also seen double masking, sometimes people putting a surgical mask over a cloth mask. Any new insights there?
You know, I think it's really if you stick to the principles of this multi-layered. So for instance, if all you have is access to a thin cloth mask, then adding something on top of it is not a bad idea because it gives you those layers. But really a single mask that is well made and that has those layers is sufficient.
We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, who's Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Health, Professor of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, getting at all of the latest COVID pandemic developments and questions with yours at 800-642-1234. Moving on to vaccines, the CDC says children age 5 and older can receive a COVID vaccine. How is vaccine availability affecting the rate of kids who are hospitalized?
Well, I think vaccine availability is in a much better place, at least locally here and in the US, than it was before. Of course, that's not the case around the globe. So there's a lot of barriers and a lot of challenges and lack of access to vaccines for everyone, including children. I think here, depending upon where one is at, there is either been a lot of desire for the vaccine, which has led parents to bring their kids to get it, and then it's been easy to get. There's also a group that are not as excited about vaccination in general, including children, and so that is a real challenge to get those rates up high.
We've seen school vaccine clinics, and we've also seen a real push to get the younger children vaccinated as they're in the classroom each day. What has uptake been as you look at Wisconsin numbers?
I think in general, uptake has been good to start with. The main thing to make sure is that every child that is eligible for vaccination gets it. You know, in the past, we've seen the uptake is good for a while, and then it plateaus off, and there's a group that that doesn't either want to take the vaccine or has access issues. And so if we can get over this vaccine hesitancy in all age groups, including children, then I think we will be in a better position.
Moving on to boosters, people over 18 who completed their primary vaccination series at least 6 months ago, eligible for a booster shot. What is the ideal time frame? What can you tell us about boosters?
So the reason for the boosters is that there is literature now pointing to the fact that the vaccine over time declines in its effectiveness. And even though that's somewhat partial data, because vaccines work in a number of ways and we're only measuring one way, which is the antibodies that decline over time. But the reason for the booster is to supplement that response. And so 6 months after the second dose is around the time when we start to see this decay in vaccine effectiveness. And so that would be a good time to get the booster.
What about mixing and matching Pfizer, Moderna? Explain what's going on there.
So there doesn't seem to be any safety concern with mixing and matching, and the effectiveness is similar or perhaps a little bit better. So at this point, the recommendation is that mixing and matching is okay.
And for people who received a J&J, a Johnson & Johnson single vaccine, can then basically take Pfizer or Moderna and do so before the six-month period?
That's right, they can. J&J was a little bit unusual because it's a different kind of vaccine and it was a single dose to begin with. But for the booster, you can have whichever of the other two.
As you look at hospitalizations and people who are very sick with COVID, what are the clinical protocols at this point in the pandemic? How can you fight this when it does get acute?
Well, you know, there will be people who either despite the vaccine or because they've chosen not to get the vaccine will get very sick from COVID because they have comorbid conditions. For instance, as one risk factor. So for those individuals who get hospitalized, the mainstay of treatment is to give steroids, to give a medication called Remdesivir, and to give another couple of medications that modulate the immune system so that the body can respond adequately to the threat of the virus. Now, all of these work to some extent, but when one is critically ill, then it means staying in the ICU, potentially being mechanically ventilated, and having all kinds of supportive measures that you need to sustain life. It's very difficult to see such patients. They may stay in the ICU for days at a time, and one hopes that, you know, they will improve, and some do, but many don't.
There has been dangerous misinformation around ivermectin in particular. What can you tell us about, you know, how to fight COVID and where the misinformation is?
I think the misinformation stemmed from an early desire to find something that worked against COVID, you know, anything. We didn't know anything about the virus. We didn't know how it worked, what sort of syndrome it would cause, and people were getting sick and dying. So the desire to find something effective was very understandable and natural. But over time, as it became clear that some things just didn't work despite one's wishes that they would, then I think we have to stay with science and realize that we've tried it. We know it doesn't work. So why subject people to the side effects of it? Unfortunately, I think that with social media, it has been so easy to spread misinformation and it looks very authentic when it's being spread. So somebody could well be taken in into thinking that something will work when really the data is very solid that it just doesn't.
I want to land here on how the medical teams are doing, how hospitals are doing, how, you know, at caring for these critically ill patients without a break. What are you experiencing at the hospital?
Well, I think at this point, you know, nearly 2 years in the pandemic, I think for the frontline clinicians, it has been hard because there really isn't, you know, a complete end in sight. Of course, we're a lot better than we were when we started out. There's now widespread availability of PPE and we have a better standard of care for patients with COVID. But nonetheless, it's like running a marathon that you don't know if it's ever going to end.
Do you see the burnout?
We do. I think healthcare workers as a group are very resilient and are able to forage ahead, you know, no matter what. But I think that at this point, this many months into it, there's definitely a feeling of burnout and fatigue. And added to that are, you know, shortages in staffing and so on, which also exacerbates the problem.
Dr. Safdar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Health and Professor of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, giving us the developments, the latest as she sees it on the COVID pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.